No surprise, no deception. It's the same crew again. Boris, we just spoke, and Misha, still present, I think, yes, and myself. So title has slightly changed. I will be speaking about the geometry of the Lagrangian dispersion. So notice that the dynamics, which was initially in the program, has disappeared for this talk. Now, I mean, obviously, there will be some similarity and some common goal between this talk and the previous talk. However, let me sort of put it in a slightly different perspective and go back to the first lecture, who sort of emphasized the usefulness, well, the fact that mixing is one of the most important properties of free turbulence. By which one means, of course, that if one release some tracer in the atmosphere or in any turbulent motion, the thing will soon be torn apart and advected in some complicated fashion. Now, of course, that property is too important to be ignored by people, and a number of important properties of this mixing have been discovered and discussed. Let me point briefly historically the work of Taylor, who back in the 1920s realized that if you follow a particle for a very long time, for time which are longer than L, which is the large scale of the flow divided by U, essentially the motion is diffusive with a coefficient, diffusion coefficient, which would be of order LU. Now, so that's for the motion for one single particle, I'd get affected by the flow. Another piece of work came slightly later by Richardson, who realized that, in fact, now if you look at the relative dispersion of particles, the actual property of the dispersion will depend very much on when you are in your fluid. So if you are very close, the diffusion will go slowly, and if you're further apart, diffusion will go faster. And by just looking at atmospheric data, he realized that the effective diffusivity can be fitted by some R to the four-third law with a coefficient which we put exception to one-third. From which one can easily infer that the growth of a swarm of the typical size of a cluster of particles will go like delta R square, go like T to the cube. Yes, okay. Typo. I said that he had that. No, you put this one for out of dimensional consideration and you solve. That's all. I mean, yeah, I'm sorry. The brilliant idea came from that. The rest is sort of nitty-gritty, which anyone can do. Of course, in a flow, Zeeman and, everybody has been mentioning that, several people have been mentioning that the geometry of the flow is much more complicated. You cannot just think of the flow as some random, completely random things. And it has been sort of seen very clearly that, in fact, there are well-organized structure in the flow. And as such, one expects that if one takes more than two particles, the geometry of the object, if you start with something which is more or less regular, the thing will be distorted in a non-trivial way, reflecting the geometry of the flow. So, in a sense, the question which I will be asking, what is the geometry of an object, a small cluster of particle, say n equal 4, just a connection with the obvious talk at this point should be more or less obvious. What happens if you start somewhere in the flow, you start with a cluster of particle at scale r, what will happen to it thereafter? Now, a remark which I want to make now is that I'm not going to look at some steady-state problem. Instead, I'm going to explicitly look at the time-dependent problem, much as if you are injecting something in the fluid and it evolves. That, in a sense, means that this work refers to the experiment that Emmanuel Villermo will be presenting later in this talk, in this conference, where he actually looks at the injection and the way things get dispersed by the flow. Now, so the question, if I take one small object at scale r, and it let it evolve with time. Presumably Richardson tells us that things will go like r to the 3/2, the overall scale will go like r to the 3/2. Now, it doesn't say much about the shape of the object. Now, before going to look at any data, what can we think of? I will sort of take some wisdom from the model which was introduced by Boris and Alexidia for a few years ago. If you have your velocity field, you can imagine that you will decompose it in several sort of bands of modes. Some of them will be large scale, which on the scale R, for an object of scale R, will have simply the result by detecting it as a wall and not doing anything as far as deformation is concerned or anything like that. Now, there will be some small scales, which will sort of, which some very fast correlation time, which will essentially be adding some noise essentially, and this noise will tend to, it is just like diffusion essentially. Now, there will be also some scale, the effect which will be due to scales comparable to the object I'm looking at, and for this kind of object, for this sort of scales, the effective motion will be some effective strain. Now, if you put an object in a strain, of course you will have some strong shape deformation and possibly some infinite deformation. If you start applying some random matrix on the same object, eventually you'll get something which will be infinitely deformed. So the question is that here there is some delicate interplay between, one, this effect of a strain acting on the object, and two, on the small scale, which will tend to reduce it. Now, how are we going to do it? So imagine that we are looking at one of these objects. So if we have n points, obviously we have to deal with three vectors. Essentially, the center of mass can be ignored because I'm just looking at deformation, so center in mass is gone. So if for n equal 4, I will have three vectors to worry about, which I can define in this way. And so essentially, you have a complicated configuration space on the R to n minus 1 times d, which will sort of there's a big configuration space. Of course, there is an overall scale which for the shape doesn't matter. So you just have to worry about something on this sphere. Now, of course, it's a big in a high-dimensional configuration space, and it's too complicated to really look at that. So, instead, the object we propose to follow is this moment of inertia-like tensor that Boris was introducing, which, if I have my vectors, rho 1, rho 2, rho 3, I'll just define this object by GAB equals sum of I, rho IA, rho IB, which gives me a symmetric matrix, and which essentially defines for me a shape. Well, it defines for me an approximation of the shape. Now, being a symmetric matrix, of course, you can diagonalize it, and clearly the eigenvectors of this object will tell me what is the overall shape of my object. So, for example, in the case where G1, there are two eigenvectors which are sort of a comparable scale and much larger than the third one, you will have an object which will be essentially a big sort of pancake-like, very much flattened on the third direction, which I didn't try to represent, but otherwise the thing will be just like a coin, if you wish. Of course, if G1 is much larger than the two other guys, you will have some very elongated object, needle-like, squeezed, and sort of a little bit like my stick here. And G1 of order G2 or the G3 will give me some regular object. Now, the quantity which we will be monitoring for trying to understand deformation will just be this ratio G2 over trace of G, trace of G being the radius of gyration. Like I was saying, for pancake-like object, I2 will be of order 1/2, regular object 1/3, and needle-like object, I2 will be small. Obviously, this number is just not the only number you can look at. You can imagine a whole lot of quantities and follow them. If you think of a triangle, you can look at the area. If you think of a tetrahedron, you can think of the volume, etc., etc., etc. I didn't say that my things are oriented by in decreasing order. So on the sum is to, you know, the ratio has to be in such a way the ratio has to be between 0 and 1/2. Sorry, I probably missed that. So you can look at all these objects. In fact, for case of triangle, you can show that a over r squared is just this ratio. I mean, so it's not very profound. Now, of course, the distribution you want to compare with is a uniform distribution of the whole of my configuration space. That would come up if you had some Gaussian distribution of my vectors rho 1, rho n. Then everything would be uniform on the sphere, and you can, for example, compute. In fact, for triangles, you can compute completely everything completely, and you have an average value of I2, which would be 1/6, and for n equal 4, you would have that sort of value. In the case of a triangle, you can do all sorts of little trivial exercises and compute pretty much everything. So I will be doing numerics. I hope I did it right. I won't put up the details. I don't think, if anyone wants, I can tell. There's nothing new there. Let me sort of discuss what will happen sort of at moderate Reynolds number it's an homogeneous isotropic it's a numerical box as usual. So you just take your box and you sort of throw in a number of these little objects and you follow them as with the flow. Now that picture is sort of the number one result. So I'm starting here at t equals 0 at 1/3 because I'm starting with regular objects, and so here I'm. In fact, all these curves refer to a number of objects with a given size, which is given in units of the Kolmogorov scale. So the lowest one corresponds to a Kolmogorov scale, a quarter of the Kolmogorov scale, Kolmogorov 4, 16, 32, 64. So this is deformation quantity followed as a function of time for different values of the initial radius. Now, the first thing one observes is that the tendency is very clear. As you go forward in time, you tend to deform strongly your object and form a needle-like structure, the more so as your distance is small. By which I mean that if I'm down to the dissipative scale, I reach these values of 0.25 as an average. Whereas if I start at larger values, I don't go nearly as deeply. I never see for tetrahedra or triangles any tendency upward, which I would see in fact for more complicated objects. But for this sort of low objects, one only sees the formation to stretch the geometry. For all the objects I have in the dissipative scales, all the curves sort of start out the same, sort of can be more or less superposed until they start being different. So here, and if I compare with various Reynolds number, I can see that this curve here is more or less uniformly scaled as a function of the Kolmogorov time. I sort of take my box and I sprinkle it with this little object with the same side, and I follow it. I can do it various ways, but that's one way to do it. So yeah, whereas at sort of a larger values of R, the time that seems to be happening, as I said, the time that seems to be showing up. I mean, that one is not too convincing, of course, because I don't have such a high inertial range. But the time that seems to be showing up is more or less the epsilon 1 minus 1 half R to 2 thirds. So all these curves superpose when we plot it in these units. So of course, there is this big dip in my deformation, I mean sort of a big growth in my deformation, and thereafter, what seems to be happening at later time is that they all come back to the value which was one corresponding to the uniform value on the sphere. So here, I tend to reach asymptotically the constant value I2 on the uniform, average on the uniform object. In fact, what you can show is that when you are at this level, the typical size of my object is larger than the inertial than the integral scale, and as such, everything relaxes, in fact, to a Gaussian distribution. So you can document that. You can show the PDF of various quantities, and they all relax to a Gaussian distribution. So this is long time, and as such, this is large distances, larger than the inertial than the integral scale. Of course, I think the effect is already seen before that. Of course, it's a big worry. Something I was not too willing to show. Not for that reason. That's the same data replotted as a function of upscale. So, you know, that would be essentially my integral scale here, which is 1, and sort of so 50 and 2 pi is the size of the box. So, you know, past that, you know, it may be a little bit wacky, but you have some strong indications that already at this point you're decently Gaussian. Now, there is some amusing. What am I doing time wise?
We have a total time of 12:20.
Oh, okay. Another 10 minutes. Okay. So maybe the thing. I will just show that slide, which is amusing. Eberhard showed us this morning some very strong fluctuation of acceleration. Here is something which I, at a qualitative level, I can vaguely wave my hand, but these are probability distribution of the volume normalized compared to the mean value. And you see that with only 20,000 particles, I reach some absolutely insane value. You have some huge fluctuation when I start at a very small value, eta over 4, down in the dissipation scale. So, I mean, these are just for these, after a while things get more nice, but you certainly also observe some huge fluctuation.
This is the probability of
volume. Yeah, so you have your object. I think that has to do with the deformation, so it's getting some huge deformation, and then if you start deforming too much, then a little bit of noise will make some crazy values of the volume. Now, obviously, so far I've been discussing, it's a numerical simulation at a relatively small Reynolds number. I'm not arguing about that. Clearly, I don't have much to say about what will happen in the inertial range. I mean, there's just no way I can do it. And presumably, even getting a sort of a four times larger simulation will be still unconvincing. Instead, if I want to try to infer what will be happening in the inertial range, what I will be using are models. So essentially, I will be using again this idea of decomposing my velocity field. So far I was doing honestly Navier-Stokes. Now I'm sort of it's another game, and it's a parameterization exercise, and that has all the advantages and all the weakness of it. Now, the thing that I will be decomposing my velocity field again, as I was saying in my first transparency, as on a large scale, which I will be ignored for the purpose I'm interested in, scales comparable to the size of the object that I want to follow, and some small scale. So large scale will be ignored as just overall translation. This one will be represented by a random straining field with a characteristic time scale, which will be of the order of what Kolmogorov tells us, namely arcs 2 over epsilon to 1/3. And these small scales will be just represented by some small scale jitter with the appropriate power so as to recover Richardson attitude. Now, the model I will be considering here is written like this in sort of a Langevin form. So my vectors, which I'm following, are called, there's three vectors, row 1, row 2, row 3, with components A. Here is my strain matrix, and here is my sort of small-scale jitter, which I take as white in time, with the appropriate power, the appropriate scaling, represented by here. Here is the evolution for my strain matrix, so which has this characteristic time tau r and some forcing like this. And in addition, I stick in two coefficients, in fact, just one could do, which are the relative strength of this jitter at small scale and of this of the forcing of my strain. So the question is, I have a proper model which I can solve in a sense. How much distortion do I get? No, it will, of course, like I said, it will, of course, depend on this ratio C of these two parameters. Now, short of solving it, what one can do is the numerical simulation, the Monte Carlo simulation, and now I'm monitoring again the same quantity as I was doing before for different size of my object initially, and they were all initialized sort of up here at 1/3, and what you see is that they all relax, they all go very quickly to some finite value, which is significantly below the value which could correspond to the Gaussian uniform distribution of shapes. So here, the Monte Carlo certainly indicates that I have some uniform distribution, some distribution of shape which is non-trivial. Of course, qualitatively, I sort of argued that it would depend on how much velocity fluctuation I have compared to how much strain I have. And this quantity will depend this limiting ratio, this asymptotic value, will grow when this quantity will grow. That is, when there is a lot of small-scale jitter, the thing will tend to be more essentially uniformly distributed on the sphere, and if there is little jitter but much strain, of course I will be able to get some much more deformed objects, and that will show here by this measure going to zero. So essentially what this model predicts is that you have a finite distortion which will of the object, which will depend on the precise value of ratio between the amount of noise you have for the velocity and for the strain. Yes. Contrary to the other one. One approach that we've been doing to try to approach this problem is to try to think of it, of the problem, in terms of the Hopf equation in the same way as it has been done for the passive scalar. I will not dwell on that for too long because for obvious time reasons. You can sort of cook up some model which will explain why you get to some final value of deformation and how do you get to it, etc., etc. The only thing I want to say is concerned maybe because of Itamar yesterday described in great detail all the shape dynamics. Certainly he did some very nice work. The only point I want to say here is that there is some subtle difference between the evolution problem as I've been doing it and the time independent problem. No, essentially, if you think of, if you want to describe your problem with some Green's function, such as this object, the problem that I've been doing here is described just by this Green's function here. In contrast, what people do when they're describing the steady state problem, they do in some way some time average, and so the remark here is that in fact, if you look at the mathematical property of the problem, these two quantities do not emphasize the same properties of the operator. So in a sense, the exercise I've been doing is not quite the same as steady state, and that you know it has. It's a different game. So with this respect, there is a subtle difference between steady state and time-dependent problem, and as such, we expect that there will be different results from experiments in the transient state. Again, if you just release a blob of particle and see how it goes away, and as if you continuously force it and pump it, and then you will see presumably some different quantity. Okay. So just in time. So, ouch. Okay, so we have looked at the distortion, sort of the geometry of swarms of particles affected by the flow. So that's among the sort of headlines. There is the fact that an object which is initially in the dissipative scale gets highly distorted, and the more so as the scale is smaller. So at large integral scales, one will access to some uniform distribution, which is essentially Gaussian. And in the inertial range, so we don't have much to trust with from the numerics, but certainly if you look at simplified models, you expect that there will be some non-trivial distortion of shapes, which will depend on the amount of, on the precise nature, so to say, on some more on some characterization of the velocity field acting on a scale R. There is this remark that doing a time-dependent problem is not should lead to different properties, although they are formally governed by the same operator. Thank you for your attention. Yes, we haven't tried. Yes, of course. I see where you want to go. We haven't done it. Well, there are other games you can do too. So. Yes. Well, okay. I mean, yeah. Yes. Right. Oh, it's just it's just the time you make up with. The usual inertial properties. You want to know that time here? Good one. It's about order one. You know, I didn't push that much because obviously my data is not, cannot, you know, what can I do?
You know the results of Garamaggi and Pope?
Yes, right. Yeah, okay, absolutely. I should have mentioned the work of Pope and company. I think what they are doing is sort of sitting infinitely in the dissipative range and sort of follow things forever and ever. Absolutely, and so they just integrate the tangent problem, and sort of look at it. Yeah. So essentially, I should have said that. So essentially, I am sort of sitting not deep enough to see all what they have. Eventually, because if they do that, essentially in this model I was putting up, that would correspond to having only m presumably. So you just multiply the thing. And so, as such, you get more and more distortion, and you get log normal probability, et cetera, which get truncated because here I sort of get out of the dissipative range and I start seeing something else.
Yeah. So they do find that they do get a positive value for this average. I too, I think.
Intermediate strain
is still positive.
Yes.
Okay, any more questions? We have an answer to a question that was first speaker.
Take a minute.